It's customary for somebody in my position to come up and tell you how delighted and honored they are to be introducing the featured guest, but it's actually true in a very singular fashion for me, and I want to tell you a little bit about that. It's important to me to introduce this man because if it were not for Roy Blunt Jr., I would not be standing here talking to you all today, I'm sure. About 20-something years ago, as John T. noted, I started out writing about what I knew best, which is a wonderful piece of advice for people who want to be writers. It's not always a great way to make a living, I discovered. I was writing about Southern culture through the lens of music at that time, and specifically through the lens of bluegrass music, and even more specifically through the lens of what was then called progressive bluegrass music, a sort of hybrid mongrel of jazz and bluegrass and rock and roll. And I knew a lot about it. There was just nobody who was publishing any work about it, except for my hometown newspaper, the Courier-Journal, blessedly, who just happened to publish what I wanted to write. But you simply could not sell a story on bluegrass to a major American magazine at that time. None of the music magazines were interested. None of the general magazines were interested, except once every 10 years someone discovered Doc Watson, and they wrote an article about that. And I kind of felt like I didn't want to go back through that territory again. Imagine my surprise then one day when I picked up Esquire magazine, and in their Music Quarterly, which used to be a regular feature, there was not only an article about bluegrass music, but a review of some of my favorite artists who were never spoken about in the press at all. Not only was there an article and a review, but lo and behold, in this Yankee magazine, there were reviews that were actually intelligent and cogent and hilarious and delightfully written and knew what they were talking about. And I was so darn excited about this that I sat down and did something I never do. You often think about doing it, but never do, which was to write a complimentary letter to a writer. Notice I say complimentary because we always write those indignant, hateful letters and get them, but everybody reads your stuff and then doesn't tell you how great it was necessarily. But this was so exciting to me that I actually wrote a letter to this gentleman who I had heard of before but knew nothing about whatsoever, and said, "Wow, aren't you something? Aren't you great? This is terrific. By the way, have you heard my favorite bands?" And then, of course, being a good fan, I threw in a couple of records. And then I looked at what I'd done, and I decided it sounded like I was the wife of somebody in the band, or at least an aspiring girlfriend. So in order to build up my credentials and credibility so this person might actually listen to these records, I threw in some of my articles for the Courier-Journal and the Louisville Times, and I packed it all up and I sent it off to Esquire, which is where the story should end, because as we all know, usually if you send the story, send your letter off to the publisher of your work, about 7 or 8 years later, they might give it to you with dust all over it and say, "Oh, this came in a couple of weeks ago." But in fact, they sent it to Mr. Blunt immediately, and in short order, I received a postcard back from him with a pretty funny Dolly Parton joke on it. And it just so happened that I happened to have a collection of Dolly Parton postcards. So I wrote him a postcard back on my Dolly, a note back on my Dolly Parton postcard. And again, this is where the story should end, because we had exhausted all two possibilities of Dolly Parton jokes at that point and had nothing else really to say to each other. Although I think I did actually get another postcard back thanking me for my postcard. Then there was a pause. And about 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from an editor at Esquire magazine saying, "Hey, we want you to write a story for us." And I said, "Wow, okay, why?" And they said, "We just went to Roy Blunt Jr. and asked him to write a story about bluegrass music." And he said, "No, he didn't think that he should do that, but he knew the person who should." This is an incredible story. Last year, when I stood up here and spoke, I spoke about mentoring and generosity and grace and how I had benefited through this organization and how I was determined to return the grace. But this is the first act of this that I experienced as a professional writer, and it truly was one of the most touching and extraordinary and great things in my life. And it led to my career. I did write that story for Esquire. They then started asking me to write about food, which resulted in the infamous cornbread story that has been published in college textbooks, which has given me a much better reputation for knowing what I write about than I probably deserve. So it is not only with delight and honor that I'm introducing Mr. Blunt, but it's also with tremendous gratitude. Those of you who would like to express a different emotion to him for the beginning of my career may do so after we are done talking, preferably not in my presence. Now, having demonstrated that I am a true Southerner by beginning with a personal anecdote instead of the business I was supposed to get about, I'm going to get on to the business, which is to tell you something about him, but this is going to require two things. The first is for me to take a big, long sip of water. The second is to put on my glasses. So I can tell you some of the things this gentleman has done in his career, but by no means all of them. Roy Blunt Jr. is the author of 15 books. I thought it was 14 until I came in, but I did check with him, thank God. And we are up to 15 now, a book that is coming out shortly called I Am Puppy, Hear Me Roar, just in time for the holiday season for your favorite best friend. He has been compared to H.L. Mencken and to Mark Twain. I think it's compliments to both of them. He is probably the contemporary master of the limerick. And I don't know how you all feel about this, but if you've never done anything else, I think that makes him a man who walks on water. I find the limerick one of the most delightful things to read and one of the most challenging things to write. I had a moment of madness. I thought I might write a limerick about him. I got as far as rhyming junior with spoon-ure and gave up. It only makes me appreciate him more that he has written some of the best limericks I've ever, ever, ever read. Maybe we can get him a little inebriated tonight and he'll recite them for us. He has a one-man show, had a one-man show in New York that was called The Most Engaging 50 Minutes in Town by The New Yorker. He's a frequent guest on other people's shows, from Prairie Home Companion to David Letterman, from Good Morning America to Politically Incorrect, and everything in between, which covers quite a lot. Being Southern, let's begin with a parochial reference. He's a columnist for the Oxford American. He has also written for several other magazines, 115 at the last count. I didn't check that number with him. I'm sure it has gone up. When you read his credits, it reads like the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature. Among other magazines, he has written for The New Yorker, Past and Present, The Atlantic, Playboy, Sports Illustrated, Esquire, Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, National Geographic, and Organic Gardening. He has written for and performed on TV and in movies, some of my favorite segments. I like the part where he appears as Truman Capote. That's very exciting to me. I watched that video over and over again just to see him and go, I met him. I really did. He's written Bill Murray's Larger Than Life. He plays in a rock and roll band, which, let's just all own up here, is the secret aspiration of every writer in this room, unless, of course, we wanted to play in a blues band, which would be the only other thing. It is called The Rock Bottom Remainders, and it has Stephen King and Amy Tan in it, among other people, a pretty auspicious group. I don't know what their music is like, but I will tell you that this is a man who writes by ear, and his writing reads like some of the best songs I have ever heard in my life. In other words, they've got a beat, and you can dance to them. My husband, Ken, said when he found out what I was about today that I should also tell you he's a real swell guy. But then Ken said to me, but exactly what does he have to do with Southern food? Well, he can be forgiven. As you can see, Roy has quite a number of credits, so it's possible that you could miss some of the most important ones. But he does have an obsessive-compulsive disorder, I think you would call it, and he has been collecting food songs for many years. Now, do correct me on this number. At last I heard was 2,300. 2,700. I was joking. I think that we should get him a McDonald's sign that he can carry around, you know, articles written. Then he pointed out that articles sold would be, you know, a smaller number, but so we all struggle on. In addition to this, he has written probably the quintessential Southern song. Is it Song for Grits?
Yeah.
Yeah. Song to Grits. Song to Grits. But, you know, he does live up there in Massachusetts and New York, so one might presume that he may have gotten above his raising in recent years. Consequently, I was delighted when I was messing around online looking for what he had done that I might be able to say that would embarrass him, to discover a live chat with Borders in which one of the questions to him was about his happiest memories of his mom, which included her reading to him, playing canasta, and eating her cooking. And the follow-up question was, of course, what did she make? And which he answered, she cooked wonderful fried chicken that was crispy and ungreasy, and cornbread, and vegetables with just a touch of pork flavor. She cooked fresh things like butter beans. They're killed lettuce, that's it. They're kind of like fresh, translucent, yellow, green lima beans. I've never had them up north, but they stand out in my memory. And okra, and homemade ice cream, and blackberry cobbler. She also made a wonderful beef stew in the pressure cooker that created a wonderful gravy that's impossible to duplicate. Now, if this is not a man who knows about Southern food, I don't know who does. But in case reciting this little mantra was not enough to convince you, I would like to nominate him as our official cheer writer for the Southern Foodways Alliance. He also collects cheers, if I remember correctly. Yes, yes. I'll tell you the one I contributed. I can't do it in a general group, but it's a very good one. Anyway, he has written the cheer for the Southern Foodways Alliance, and it goes like this. I want us all to learn it later. I'm not doing hand motions. True grits, more grits, fish grits, and collards. Life is good where grits is swallowed.
Well, thank you, Ronnie. You made me hungry, which so do your books. I will take as my text a passage from my favorite book, Norwood by Charles Portis. There's an ex-Marine named Norwood Pratt comes up from Ralph, Texas to collect a debt of $70 from an ex-Marine friend of his. And who lives in New York, and Norwood finds himself in the East Village, 11th Street, and somewhere in East Village, and says, on the sidewalk in front of the place, some shirtless Puerto Rican boys were roasting marshmallows over a smoldering mattress. Norwood stopped and looked at the tenement number and rested the guitar on his foot. You boys having a big time? It's a campfire, said one. He was wearing huge comic sunglasses and had his head tilted back to keep them on. He offered Norwood a blackened marshmallow from the end of a straightened-out coat hanger. I believe I'd rather have one right out of the sack, said Norwood. They ain't going to taste like anything cooked over hair. I've lived, since 1968, I have lived mostly in New York City and up in the country, western Massachusetts, so thought I would talk to you about the difficulties of being a person who loves Southern food in the North. There's a song by Margaret Johnson, one of the food songs that I've collected, called Folks in New York City Ain't Like the Folks Back Home. No, they ain't like the folks back south. And it goes, the horses and the numbers keep most of them alive. All they eat is hot dogs when eating time arrives. But, of course, there are black neighborhoods in New York, so you can get Southern food. You always could, but you have to look for it. And the first time I came to New York was, first time I ate fried chicken in the North. I got off a plane flying up there to do something for the summer and went just in the airport. I was hungry and sat down in the airport coffee house and lunch counter there and ordered fried chicken. And they called it Maryland fried chicken, which I figured fried chicken's fried chicken. But then they served me something that it was just, I think that, the difference between Northerners' approach to certain kinds of food and Southerners is the difference between sympathy and empathy. For instance, I heard somebody, Mia Farrow or somebody, said she would not eat anything that had a face. I said that to some friends of mine once when we were fishing, and just bothered my friend Jim C. Just every now and then he'd say, now, fish doesn't have a face because it's all on one side. You wouldn't call that a face. So, now, a crab doesn't have a face. It's all out on the end of the stalks, and that's not a face. But in other words, you just decide, well, that has a face, so I sympathize with it, so I'm not going to eat it. I just can't bear to eat it. But on the other hand, there is a more Southern approach, which is that you and the chicken or the pig or whatever are in this together. You know, there's not really much reason for a whole lot of chickens in the world if people aren't going to eat them. And this chicken that I was served, it was like coming up to New York City and running into a girl, a nice girl that you went to high school with, who had gotten all dissolute and bleary-eyed and had just clearly been mistreated. I just felt bad for this chicken. I just didn't know what to say to it. You know, I just wanted to take it back home to Jesus or something. Just lay there. It was all, it needed a bath or something, just all greasy and nasty and some kind of wet kind of batter on it. I couldn't understand. Because it's so I think that, I mean, I ate it anyway, but I didn't enjoy it very much. And I feel like I owed it to the chicken to eat it. I mean, at least I could do. I didn't owe it to the cook, but I did owe it to the chicken. There was a thing the other day in the New York Times about how lard has been rehabilitated as a, you see that? Yeah. Apparently, lard is better for you than butter because butter, the kinds of fats that deposit cholesterol are higher in butter than the kinds of fats that eat cholesterol up, or whatever it is. But lard is higher in the good cholesterol and lower in the bad cholesterol. So, Amen. Yeah, let's hear it for lard. But the for one thing, though, it bothered me. I mean, my mother went to her grave thinking she had injured her family by cooking them lard. Now, she can't read the news. I started to write a letter to the New York Times and say, where were you when my mother was dying? Too late now to rehabilitate lard. But the one line in some nutrition expert was quoted as saying, lard is no big deal. And sell that to the pig. I wrote a little couplet about it. Was inspired to write a little couplet, which is, it's nowhere near as hard for a cow to give butter as a pig to give lard. I also started writing something about a sort of hymn to eating meat, which, a lot of vegetarians, and I like vegetables, and I respect people who don't eat meat, but I just would hate to not eat meat. And So I wrote this: cold, warm, or hot meat, sliced thick or thin, I guess I've just got meat under my skin. You can get good fried chicken in New York now, of course. It's not as good as my mother's, but it's good. You can get all these chain fried chicken places, and you can get Krispy Kreme donuts in New York. Now, when I went to came up to New York in the first place, it was, one reason I wanted to go to New York is because I figured they knew everything, because they knew all this stuff that I didn't know, and I assumed they also knew what I knew and just didn't bother to mention it. But I got up there and ate donuts in New York, and I couldn't believe why they had these donuts when they could have Krispy Kremes. And there's these old heavy dead donuts, and you could get Krispy Kremes, which come off when they're hot. Now they got to be hot when they're coming off the line. You can see them rolling down off cooking. There's just a whole lot of little round things coming down and plopping down, and you watch them coming down the chute, and then you eat them hot and they just melt in your mouth. I don't know why I'm telling y'all about Krispy Kreme, but many years later, I'll get into Krispy Kreme later, but many years later, the New York Times called me up and said there's going to be a Krispy Kreme on 23rd Street in New York, and would you write something about it? And I thought, well, geez. And then I was able to vent fact that I had always assumed New Yorkers knew everything until I found out they didn't know about Krispy Kremes, and I had to tell them about it. Because where I come from, people don't necessarily want to know everything. I just assume, I do have one limerick that I wrote recently. It's called, it's about religion and Southern education. It's, see if I remember it. At U of Alabama, a wary Delta Gamma, as class was adjourning, said, I'm not learning anything Christ wouldn't, am I? But in New York, they want to know everything, I figured, and I was able to tell them about Krispy Kreme. It's a good thing. They even have goo-goo bars now. Go get a goo-goo. I think they think it stands for good government up there, and I don't want to tell them. So you can get food up there. But there's a parallel problem here, issue, which my friend Dan Mayfield, we were in Memphis last night, and Dan mentioned that, you can get a lot better Southern food. It's a lot easier to get good Southern food in the North than it is to get good Northern food in the South. Now, one reason he said that was because he defined Northern food as a little piece of meat over here and a chunk of potato, old Irish boiled potato over here, not touching, and in between them, two old hard pointed green beans and not touching either one of them. So you can't get any good Northern food like that anywhere, of course. But there are, of course, great, good, fine Northern foods like pasta. Last night, in the last two nights in Memphis, I've had something that I think ought to be stamped out, which is barbecued spaghetti. There are just things that ought not to be barbecued. Pasta ought not to be maroon. It just doesn't look right, and it's all mushy and everything. And I think maybe it'd be a good thing for this conference to put out a policy statement, a list of foods that ought not to be barbecued, northern foods. Cheesecake might be one, you know, and sushi. And it's tempting to barbecue sushi, I know. You at least you see it there, and you at least want to brown it a little bit or something. But because I've always held that the way sushi was invented was there was some smart Japanese marketers over there in Tokyo or something, and back before they started getting in trouble, and they were over there trying to think of something they could sell in America. And they said, well, why don't we sell some kind of fish, start a range of a whole bunch of fish restaurants. And they said, well, that'd be pretty good. How would we cook it? And one of them said, you know what we could do? And they just got away with it. And, you know, they don't eat raw fish over there. But in fact, I heard that Walmart is going to have wine now. Going to have a line of wines, their own Walmart wines. They're going to get into more luxury things. So I'm afraid they will get into sushi. And you'll ask where the sushi is, and they'll say, oh, it's over in Sporting Goods. You know. Okay. The reason I raise all these issues is that I have become a sort of buffer person, you know, because I live in New York. For instance, I went one time I picked up the New York Times one morning, and it said in the headline, Old Southern Custom of Eating Dirt, Seen on the Wane. Which meant that, people where I come from are not eating as much dirt as they used to, but still eating a lot of dirt. And, I knew that this was going to come up because, went to some fashionable soiree that night, and somebody, a woman with a crew cut, came over to me and said, I thought I knew all about the South, you know, how you all got kind of too friendly with farm animals sometimes and sat around spinning yarns and flies on the baby and all that. And but I never realized that you ate dirt, you know. And there are two ways you can go on that. You can, since I'm from Georgia, you can either take the Jimmy Carter approach, which is to say, well, now, just try to tell the truth and say, now, I know there's a lot of, there are perfectly nice folks who do chew on clay for various reasons, but actually, nobody in my family ate dirt, and I actually don't think I know anybody who eats dirt, you know. And if you do that, they will just look at you and say, uh-huh. Here is somebody who comes from people who eat dirt, and he thinks he is better than they are, which means you're both trashy and inauthentic, which is a terrible combination. So you have to take the Billy Carter approach and say, hell yes, we eat dirt. If you never had any black and red dirt, you don't know what's good. Because they'll believe you. I started to start a chain of dirt restaurants, actually. Could have gotten away with it for years. The Japanese got away with the sushi thing. So the New York Times asked me to explain about Krispy Kreme, and I did. I wrote about Krispy Kreme for the New York Times magazine and pointed out that, you know, Krispy Kreme donut is to a regular donut like as a angel is to a person. It's just a whole different kind of melt in your mouth kind of thing and all that. And Krispy Kreme's, I don't know. Then Krispy Kreme company called me up and wanted me to address their employees. And I said, well, not what I wanted to do really. I don't want to make money. You know, I shouldn't write something in a paper and then get paid to talk to the people that made it, they'll think I've worked out a deal ahead of time and all that, and it just wouldn't be appropriate. And they said, well, why don't you do it for free? And I said, well, that would be even less appropriate. So I didn't do that. But I kept seeing, and I'm glad I didn't do it, because now the Krispy Kremes in New York, I went by one the other night, and the light was on, meaning that the hot donuts were hot, you know, and that was one of the great things, one of the few sort of random things in American marketing these days. They don't turn on the light till they're hot donuts. If you drive by and the light's off, you just don't get any, you just wait till you drive by another time and the light's on. I mean, this place had the light on, and I went in there, and the donuts weren't hot. I don't know how to explain, how to tell you how, if you don't know about Krispy Kreme, didn't grow up with Krispy Kreme, it's sort of, I don't know, it's like, I don't know, going in, it's just, you shouldn't do that. Nobody should do that. It corrupted the hot, donuts are hot sign. And the guy said, well, the manager just told us to do that, said more of them come in when there's the hot sign on. You know, it's just America for you. But I went into this place called the Gourmet Garage, which is downstairs from an apartment building in New York, and there was a sign. They were, had cold Krispy Kreme donuts, which are not bad, but and they were selling them cold, and there was a sign above them saying, fresh from the antebellum South. So I went up... Went up to the guy at the bakery counter there and said, well, it can't be too fresh, right? And he didn't see any, he just sort of narrowed his eyes. And I think all the English he could speak was, it's time for my break. I think the only thing he knew. But so, and just as I was trying to explain to him, a woman ran up to me with a plug in her ear. So thing you talk through, you know, and she said, what is the tune to Rambling Wreck from Georgia Tech? And just out of the blue, this strange woman ran up to me, and I realized later on, finally, it hit me that I had somebody give me a hat that was said Georgia on it. And I guess these people, she was making a movie. They were making a movie. She said, we know the words. And I guess they just sent people out all over New York to looking for somebody wearing a hat that said Georgia on it so they could find out the tune. We know the words, she said. We just need to have the tune. We're making a film. And I said, well, I'm glad you asked me that. I was a Georgia Tech fan when I was a kid, and she said, we need to know the tune, you know, to know her. I said, well, I don't carry a tune too well. I'm not all that good a singer. In fact, and she said, could you just try to carry a tune? I said, well, I'm a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech and a heck of a, no, she said, hell of a. I said, well, we said heck of a at home. I don't know, grew up in a Methodist home, and then she went. And so it seemed to me, and then she just ran off. She got enough of the tune and left me there, standing there. And I still feel I should be able to get some kind of consultant thing in the movies to, because I have collected over 2,700 food songs. And in fact, some of them give you real words. One of the things I live by is, it ain't going to taste like anything cooked over hair. Another one, Richard Pryor tells one of his mud bone stories, and they go to visit the conjure woman, and the monkey jumps on one of them's head, and he's slapping at the monkey, and she says, don't mess with the monkey. The monkey live here. Y'all just visiting. Throw y'all out. Another one is a food-related one, and a Eudora Welty story, the wide net. Now, I've forgotten the name of this family, but there's a rough old family that lives up in the hills. They think that a woman is drowned, and they're dragging the river. Y'all probably know this. A lot of you know this story, the wide net. The woman has run off from her husband, and they think she's drowned in the river, so everybody in town gets together to drag the river, and I think their name is, well, let's say their name's Wilson, just in honor of Charles. This rough family has come down from the hills to help them drag the river, and you don't see the Wilsons come down into town very often, and they're down there helping drag, and everybody started looking at the Wilsons, and somebody says, I think the Wilsons are just in it for the fish. I think that's true of a lot of people. A lot of undertakings. Then there's, whenever anybody asks me, writes for advice on how to be a writer, I quote a food song by Wynonie Harris, called, or he sings it anyway, called Keep On Churning Till the Butter Comes. What's that? All you can do when you write, just keep on doing it. And another one is, I once wrote some, Civilization Magazine called me up and wanted me to write, so they were going to do a whole issue about giving and wanted me to write something. And I said, well, I'll write about gimme caps. And they didn't know what that was, never heard of what that was. So I said, well, I'll write about something. I'll work something up. And I wrote an essay based on a song by Memphis Minnie called, or a song sung by Memphis Minnie, at any rate, called I'm selling my pork chops, but I'm giving my gravy away. They didn't understand it at all. I mean, I explained it to them. I said, you know, you got to make a living, so you sell your pork chops, but there's some things too precious to sell. You got to give those away. So I think we can all understand that anything cooked over hair is not going to have any gravy. I did a thing on in New York in the theater, in the Off-Broadway theater, and I didn't really think I was ready for the theater. So I figured I better work out, audition somehow and work my way up to the theater. So I went down into the subway. And because you have singers now down around the subway, people playing music and stuff in the subway. And I thought, well, I'll just do a little monologue in the subway. I got there and was just about to start talking when I realized that there was a much more interesting conversation than I could provide going on right near me. There's this couple who were dressed all in black leather, and they seemed to have lizards tattooed all over themselves. I don't know, I of course couldn't tell but you could see the head of a lizard coming out under the wrist here and the tail of a lizard going down into the collar and everything. But they were having an argument that couples who don't have lizards tattooed all over themselves might well have. He was saying to her, you don't share your life with me. He said, I tell you about what I do, but I have to hear about what you do from other people. She said, well, what do you mean? Like, what did I tell you about? And he said, well, how about Francesco? She said, well, I thought you knew about Francesco. He's just, when I first came to the city here, he's one of the first people I met, and he's just really nice to me and all. And the guy said, see, that's exactly what I mean. I pick a name out of the air. Who the hell is Francesco? So I just gave up on trying to work the subway. But it did make me realize that there are a lot of questions that people have I figured it might improve a lot of Broadway plays if there was question and answers from the floor long after a couple of acts, And for instance, Othello, after a tragedy might well be averted if the audience could raise some questions from the floor. So I did, right in the middle of my one-man show, I just threw the floor open for questions. So I thought I might do that here and now. Has anybody got any questions all about it? It's a lot of material to cover, and I don't know whether I've gone too fast for you. If there's anything we skipped right over, let me know. What southern food do they do the best job with in New York? There are places, good places. They can't do barbecue, really, because you can't cook. I mean, we're just talking about this place called Virgil's on, 40, just off Times Square, which is not bad. They have barbecue from everywhere. They have barbecued mutton from Kentucky, and they have barbecued pork from North Carolina, and they have barbecue, so there's a map, all different. So they're too eclectic to begin with. But mainly, they have a big pile of firewood as you just walk through the door, but that same firewood is there all the time. It's just decor firewood. They don't cook on the premises. So they do as well as they can for not cooking on the premises. They probably do cook over mattresses, in fact. I don't know what they're doing. But you can get good. You can get there some good places to eat southern food. And hey, John. Anything else? Yeah. Ooh, I tell you what. I'll read y'all some of my food poems, which will tell you exactly what some of the things I remember. Here's one: A Song to Greece. I feel that I will never cease to hold in admiration Greece. Its grease makes frying things so crackly, during and after. Think how slackly bacon lies before its grease effusively secures release. Then that same grease protects the eggs from hard burnt ruin. Grease, it begs comparison to that old stone that turned base metals gold. The only thing that grease won't do with food is make it evanesce once chewed. In fact, grease lends a certain weight that makes it clear that you just ate something solid, something thick, something like das Ding an sich. This firm substantiation is allied directly with the sizzle. Oh, when our joints refuse to function, when we stand in need of unction, bring us two pork chops apiece, a skillet, lots of room, and grease. Though batter's great and fire is too, and so if you can fry or you, what lubricates and crisps at once, that's grease, makes all the difference. This is a song to grits. When my mind's unsettled, when I don't feel spruce, when my nerves get frazzled, when my flesh gets loose, what knits me back together is grits. Grits with gravy, grits with cheese, grits with bacon, grits with peas. Grits with a minimum of 2 over medium eggs mixed in them. Grits, grits, it's grits I sing. Grits fits in with anything. Rich and poor, black and white, Lutheran and Campbellite, Southern Jews and Jesuits all acknowledge buttered grits. Give me 2 hands, give me my wits, give me 40 pounds of grits. Grits at taps, grits at reveille, I am into grits real heavily. True grits, more grits, fish grits and collards. Life is good where grits are swallowed. Grits sits right. People ask me, come up to me with this funny look on their face and ask me about grits. It's like, I can understand if it was about, bestiality or something, but grits, I mean, it's like going up to a Chinaman and saying, now tell me about this rice, you know, what's it? It soaks up the food, or the juice, you know. Okra, here's solid okra. This has my most egregious rhyme in it, I believe. See if you can sense it coming on. String beans are good and ripe tomatoes and collard greens and sweet potatoes, sweet corn, field peas, and squash and beets. But when a man rears back and eats, he wants okra. Good old okra. Oh, wow, okra. Yes, sirree. Okra is okay with me. Okra's favored far and wide. You can get it boiled or fried, either slick or crisp inside. Oh, I once knew a man who died without okra. Little pepper sauce on it. Oh, I want it. Okra. Old Homer Ogletree's so high on okra, he keeps lots laid by. He keeps it in a safe he locks up. He eats so much, can't keep his socks up. That was one of my father's 2 great jokes. He would say, I once knew a man ate so much okra, he couldn't keep his socks up. It's another thing that Civilization magazine probably wouldn't understand. My father's other favorite joke was, you think I'm stupid, you ought to see my brother. He walks like this. Can't keep his socks up. Which goes to show it's no misnomer when people call him Okra Homer. That's not it. It's still coming up. Okra, oh, you can make some gumbo with it. Most of all, I like to get it all by itself in its own juice, lying there all nice and loose. That's okra. It may be poor for eating chips with. It may be hard to come to grips with. But okra is such a wholesome food, it straightens out your attitude. Mmm, is how discerning folk respond when they are served some okra. That's it. That's the most egregious. Okra's green, goes down with ease. Forget cuisine, say okra, please. You can have strip pokra. Give me a nice girl and a dish of okra. This is a hymn to Ham. Though Ham was one of Noah's sons, like Japheth, I can't see that Ham meant any more to him than Ham has meant to me. On Christmas Eve, I said, yes, ma'am, I do believe I'll have more ham. I said, yes, ma'am, I do believe I'll have more ham. I said, yes, ma'am, I do believe I'll have more ham. And then after dinner, my uncle said he was predominantly English, but part Cherokee. As near as I can figure, I said, I am an 1/8 Scotch-Irish and 7/8 ham. Ham, my soul, I took a big hot roll, I put in some jam and butter that melted down in with the jam, which was blackberry jam, and a big old folded over oozy slice of ham, and my head swam. Ham, hit me with a hammer, wham, bam, bam, what good am I without my ham? Ham's substantial, ham is fat, ham is firm and sound, Ham's what God was getting at when he made pigs so round. Aunt Faye's as big as she can be. She weighs 100, she must weigh 3. But Faye says, Ham, oh Lord, praise be. Ham has never hampered me. Next to Mama and Daddy and Graham, we all love the family Ham. Any other questions? I can. You want to read? You want me? I just. Anybody? Any more questions? Okay. I'll read some more food porn. I've got a lot of interesting material about food songs, but sometimes I get a little too obsessive about that. Song to barbecue sauce. Hot and sweet and red and greasy, I could eat a gallon easy. Barbecue sauce, lay it on, hoss. Nothing is dross under barbecue sauce. Brush it on chicken, slosh it on pork. Eat it with fingers, not with a fork. I could eat barbecued turtle or squash. I could eat tar paper cooked in a wash in barbecue sauce. I'd eat Spanish moss with barbecue sauce. Hear this from Evelyn Billiken Husky, formerly Evelyn B. of Sandusky. Ever since locating down in the South, I have had barbecue sauce on my mouth. I'll read you. Somebody asked me, an airline magazine asked me to go do a pilgrimage somewhere. And I went to, down to Nashville, where I went to college, to a place called the, I forgot what it's called. I'll read the story. It comes out. Ooh, Jesus, what's that? It's called the, I'll read y'all. This is kind of a dessert poem. Wait a minute. This is something that never has been heard anywhere before. This thing I'm going to read you now. But here's something else. I'll read you this first. It's kind of long. I'll read the last part. I went down to, talking about meeting threes. And the kind of, I never knew the expression meeting three. It's like the expression good old boy. I never heard that. Just back home, we said, well, he's a good old boy. We didn't think of it as a noun, it's just sort of an expression, like it's a good old truck, or he's been a good old husband to me. Suddenly, good old boy became this kind of sociological term. And meat and three is sort of like that. It was just a place where you would go, get some meat and three vegetables. Just a place to eat. And I lost the first page of this place. Oh, well. I was going through this in the car. Well, I'll read some. Let me read you a little bit. Maybe it'll come out while I'm reading about food songs. Here's the thing about crabs. The question of whether, some people just don't like to eat crabs. And this was put off by the way the crabs look. This is the two-part thing. There's another one about lobster I don't have here. One of them, this one is called Justifications for Ingesting Crustaceans. And this is called Don't Recoil from Blue Crabs Boil. True, crabs do have far too many tiny mouth parts and antennae, and even at the end of and eyes at the end of movable stalks, and the way a crab walks, or skitters, or whatever the word is for how a crab goes, doesn't make you want to holler, I'll have one of those. Crabs do arise from murky places, and the looks crabs get on what pass for their faces, few expressions are foreigner. And taking crabs apart requires the sang-froid of a coroner. And after eating several, you may smell like one for days, but don't avert your gaze. All those drawbacks don't amount to much against what crabs boil down to. Flex wisps, tidbits, dribs, and drabs. The meat that one with effort nabs from crabs is absolutely dreamy, which is why, sweet dining partner, you may see me pinch myself or feel me pinching you. It's no more than the crab would do. I wish I could find the beginning of this thing about... anybody got any questions while I'm looking? I can actually look things up while answering questions. Not to say I can find things while I'm... Yeah. It might be a little off color if it came to mind. Let's see. Huh? Well, I don't know. I'd have to think. I'd have to think about it. I'd be thinking about that limerick while I'm looking something up. Well, I'll read you this dessert thing. Not a limerick versus it. What undid Uncle Bob? Uncle Bob was never sick, his appetite robust. He liked his steak 2 inches thick, and onions were a must. potatoes, sweet or mashed with gravy, and peas and buttered bread, beans, lima green and navy, and cabbage by the head. And out of curiosity, people sometimes queried, "Bob, what serving might this be?" And he would say, unwearied, "Oh, maybe 10th or 12th. Another wouldn't hurt, and yet he never felt himself deserving of dessert. "No to pie or cake," he'd say. "There I draw the line. After what I've put away, just coffee would be fine." Some called it a religious thing, said Bob's a Puritan. You notice of an evening, he'll watch the setting sun, and then he'll say, "We're only here a little while, and puff, we're gone." The fact is, Bob's austere, and meat is sweet enough. That seemed to be the case, but then Grace Wages came to town. Widowed, 14 local men proposed. She turned them down. But Bob she took a liking to, a challenge to her cooking. To Bob she said, "Now I think you are right likely looking." He loved her biscuits, loved her ham, but when she mentioned pie, he said, "It's just the way I am." She said, "But Bobby, I think it's time you left your shell. You're tight. Let down your guard." "Well, if you put it that way, well," he said, and swallowed hard. For who could fail to want to need what Grace urged him to savor? She said if he would try it, she'd consider it a favor. And so at last Bob did indulge in what he'd not before, her pie and ice cream topped with fudge, and hand whipped cream and more. Yes, more, the thing he'd always known would in the end undo him. A thing so sweet no man could own, he had it coming to him. She gave it, and it moved his heart as nothing had before. He rose and said, "Till death us part," and whoa, he hit the floor. And now our Uncle Bob's to bury, who never had a cough. And yes, that maraschino cherry it was that topped him off. I'm making myself hungry. All right, here it is. I remember the first time I had lunch in the Ellington Place Soda Shop in Nashville, Tennessee. It was my freshman year at Vanderbilt University, spring of 1960. That morning, in Understanding Poetry, the anthology we used as a text in English, I had encountered a poem by Wallace Stevens entitled "No Possum, No Sop, No Taters." I didn't understand it. It was bleak, spare, a hard sunless sky, dry leaves scraping across frozen ground, a rusty crow with a malicious eye. I had never eaten possum, have since then, of course, but I knew sop, and I knew taters, and I couldn't see what this poem had anything to do, even negatively, with down-home country eating. It was like seeing an old neighbor of yours pop up in a movie acting like somebody else. I asked Professor Bennett to explain "No Possum, No Sop, No Taters" to me. He said he didn't understand it either, which didn't seem to bother him. He was a highly educated man, and yet he had accepted that there were things he would never get. I didn't get that. I was a good reader. I saw no reason why I couldn't get everything. I knew there were things that my parents didn't want me to get, but I hadn't come to college to stay within those parameters, had I? It stuck in my craw, that poem. The next most interesting thing that had happened to me in my freshman year was the realization that poetry wasn't fancy la-di-da writing. It was writing that had been simmered down to a mingling of essentials, like my mother's beef stew gravy, which died with her 20 years later. And the thing was, I could tell that this Wallace Stevens poem was good somehow. I just couldn't tell anything else about it. I decided to venture off campus for lunch. A block away from the campus was Elliston Place, where I found the Elliston Place Soda Shop. It is still there with its neon ice cream soda sign out front. I revisited it for lunch recently and remembered that first time. The Elliston Place Soda Shop is what is called today a meet and three. I wouldn't have called it that back then because in 1960 because meet and three wasn't a cultural term back then. The Elliston Place Soda Shop was a combination of a soda fountain, which you usually found in a drugstore back then, and a home cooking restaurant where it pretty much went without saying that you could get a meat portion and your choice of three vegetables for $1.95. And you would know what you were getting when you ordered, say, squash casserole or candy yams, or, well, take rice and gravy. It wouldn't be as good as my mother's rice and gravy, but it would be along the same lines, which is to say, good, light, fluffy white rice, almost sweet in its clean unsaltiness, with good charcoal brown gravy, salty and slightly peppery, murky in a good sense, not in a bad sense greasy, made of flour and a little milk, I guess, and beef drippings. In season, tender, fresh, yellow-green lima beans, such as I have never seen outside the Deep South to this day. In any season, turnip greens or collard greens, string beans cooked way down with pork so that they were not at all fibrous anymore and yet had a chewy consistency by dint of which they gave a good account of themselves. Deep down in there somewhere, they were still green. Cornbread. That would be in addition to your three vegetables. Here's something that tends to be lost sight of in Southern cooking when it leaves the region. Cornbread ought not to be sweet or fluffy, any more than a gravel road ought to be boggy. Cornbread is crunchy and a little buttery, but you can always put butter on it. Mainly it tastes and chews like cornbread, not like cake. And of course, your meat portion might be fish fried salty and cornmeal gritty, or chicken fried lightly, no greasy flaps of skin and no butter to speak of, batter to speak of, just a flecky patina of expertly browned flour and skin. Macaroni and cheese, it wasn't just sticky yellow macaroni with a cheesy taste, it was marbled and layered like a trifle. Chewy orange and softer pale yellow and milky off-white and noodles of a cleanness like the rices in rice and gravy. You find fewer and fewer meat and threes these days in the South, and of course not all of them were ever good enough to evoke my mother's cooking. The Elliston place soda shop was, though. Comfort food, people call such fare today. That's condescending. Fiber of being food is more like it. I love fine dining, but fine dining doesn't remind you of your grandmother, who would sit down at the dinner table and somebody would ask her, "Are you hungry, Mama, after all that cooking?" And she would say, "Well, I guess I can worry down a mouthful or two." And then she would pitch in as strong as the rest of us. Or my mother's cousin Effie. No, I think it was Effie who always had to go to the bathroom when it was time to wash the dishes. Cousin somebody would always say, "No, she didn't want any watermelon, thank you." And then you'd offer her a bite of your piece of watermelon. Not a slice of watermelon, but a quadrant of a whole melon. Because that way, everybody was sure of getting some of the heart. Because that way, everybody, the center, the very sweetest and least seedy part. And this cousin would come along and say, "Well, she guessed she would have just one bite of watermelon, and then she'd take your piece's very heart." Anyway, I sat there in the Elliston Place soda shop 38 years ago and ate a good lunch and decided I would get no possum, no tater, sop, no taters in due time. I get it now, pretty much, partly because I don't expect to get things quite the same way I expected to back then. I don't expect cooking like my mother's anymore, either. So I wasn't too crushed to find when I revisited the Elliston Place soda shop recently that it wasn't as good as it used to be. I mean, it wasn't bad, but friends of mine in Nashville said, yeah, it was a shame. They'd stopped going there lately, new ownership or something. Actually, I was crushed a little bit, way back down inside where I am still green. Right. Anybody got anything else? I mean, I'll just stand here, but I would a lot rather go eat. Yeah. What I want them to eat? The question is, talking about childhood food, what on the day of my funeral, what do I want people to eat? I don't guess there'd be any chance that I would be alive on the morning of the day of my funeral. I don't know. Well, I mean, if I was around to eat some of it, I would. It would probably be breakfast, because I surely wouldn't be alive by lunch if it was the day of my funeral. Sausage, you know, I love country sausage. Well, that's a good question. What would people eat? I would probably feel so bad that I wasn't getting some of it. That I think they ought to eat something awful so they feel bad. If they eat anything good, they'll stop thinking about me. Yeah. Well, raisin pie. I think I've had raisin. What else is in it besides raisins? Tradition in Pennsylvania is raisin pie. I've spent some time in Pittsburgh, and I think I had some raisin pie. They have spots, and there's a little fish. In Virginia, you get spots, too, I think. In North Carolina, yeah. I never Yeah, we never had spots growing up, but in Pittsburgh, for some reason, they all eat these little bitty fried fish called spots. It's interesting how every town, every place has just completely different things. You know, I never realized it until some years ago that people in Mississippi ate tamales. You know, just, I don't know where else. They just come up from Mexico, I guess. I don't know. Yeah.
I had an update on that Walmart
line. Oh, yeah?
The
new Target. The update on the Walmart wine thing is that the new Target show is a store in where? Birmingham sells sushi. Is it right fresh and everything? And Joan says her sister pronounces Target as Tarjay, so it might be. Yeah. Well, there's a place called Jezebel's, which has sort of real, over on the west side, which has real. Kind of fancy New Orleans, kind of exotic Charleston southern food that's good. There's this place, Virgil's Barbecue, is not bad. There's a place up in Harlem called Wells, which they have great music up there. They do swing dancing and stuff, and they have real good just southern food. There are several places around. There's a place called the Pink Teacup down in the village that's been there for years. It's really pretty good. Yeah, there's a lot of vegetables and stuff. So you can get it if you really try. But it hadn't been that long, and I mean, I remember for years you just couldn't. They just didn't know what fried chicken was until, you know, Colonel Sanders and everybody started having decent. It was just all wet fried chicken. I just could never understand. Yeah.
You said your mother took her bean stew recipe.
What's
her? Does she make it
with cornbread? Yeah, I do. My sister makes it. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it wasn't fluffy at all. It was flat. You know, I kind of like real gritty cornbread. It doesn't have to be. Yeah, her beef stew she made in the pressure cooker, and she would put chunks of stew beef and onions and carrots and potatoes and just throw it all in there. I don't think she put anything else in it. I don't know. It didn't take anything else. And just made. And you would sop that gravy out with cornbread. It was just good. And have cabbage with it, too, on the side. God. Whew. Yeah. Remember where I was? I was probably in my mama's lap. I don't know. It was very, very early on when I ate my first crispy. I remember eating my first pizza at a football game at Georgia Tech. I had heard about pizza pies or something. And I thought I didn't much like it at the time, but I come to like it. And I remember eating the first yogurt, too. It was in Harvard Square. And I thought, oh, it's sour. Nobody ever told me it's sour. But I've come to like yogurt, too. But no, yeah. What? My daughter lives in Chapel Hill, and she eats, you know, we go to, what's that, Bullard's place in Chapel, Bullard's, yeah, Bullard's, isn't that the name of that place? Bullock's or Bullard's? Bullock's. We go there and eat barbecue and stuff. She loves barbecue, yeah, and my son is always trying to take me around to new southern places in New York. He lives in New York, so they haven't figured out. I mean, I always thought they would learn. They didn't learn that you have to make a living exactly. You know, I mean, they're making a living, but they didn't learn that you need to make a little more than a living, which I thought, you know, somehow I fancied that my children would become yuppies and I would complain about them, you know, or they would marry rich lawyers and I would think, oh, granny, and I wouldn't have to worry about them. I could just complain about them. But now I'm proud of them, but I'm worried that they don't make enough money. How are they going to support me when I... But they did learn about southern food, and they absorbed the right things, I guess. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's other kind of good food too, of course, and I still love to eat good food. And I tell you what, though, the terrible thing is that I don't know. It's well, obviously, it's partly age, but it's partly also just my metabolism has changed somewhat. I can't eat as much. Fried stuff and barbecue as I used to. I've been eating barbecue already the last 2 days and stayed woke up with heartburn, and you know, it's a shame. But I intend to eat everything y'all put before me, I'll tell you that. Even if I die. Yeah. Yeah, you can get grits in New York. I mean, the closer you get to black neighborhoods, you can get them in the stores and in like coffee shops. There's this place at 90, a couple of places around me up on the Upper West Side, 96 and Bravo. Yeah, good, you know, the grits. You know. yeah, they're fine. I mean, you know, I don't get too fancy with grits. All these sort of stone ground. I mean, I like fancy grits that you have to cook for an hour, but I won't eat instant grits, but I can eat quick grits, you know, 20-minute grits. You know, there's a great, what's that movie, Uncle Vinny, or no, what? Cousin Vinny, yeah. Well, the whole plot turns on what grits are and how long it takes grits to cook. That's, anybody else? Okay. Thank you, John.